not hopeful for everybody here. What are they going to do? There's no help. I don't see nothing happening over here.
A campground that was open to Anchorage's homeless is set to close on Saturday. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 29th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a dozen Aleutian communities are set to get high-speed internet.
Next is really rebuilding the community, right? What kind of jobs can we put into the community to encourage people to move home?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
President Joe Biden has made more disaster aid available to Alaska in response to Western Alaska storm damage this month. Biden revised the federal disaster declaration for Alaska this morning, increasing the federal payment to 100% of the total eligible costs for the first 30 days. The decision means that the state won't have to pay any costs associated with initial assistance to residents and communities who suffered losses from the remnants of Typhoon Murbach. The total cost of the disaster has not been tallied yet. The widespread damage includes flooded streets in downtown Nome, lost subsistence food and fishing boats in Chivac, and the destruction of Shaktulik's berm against the sea. Biden's action comes 2 days after Alaska's congressional delegation and governor requested the change. On Thursday, they issued a joint statement thanking Biden for his swift action. A bill Congresswoman Mary Peltola sponsored passed the House today, a bit more than 2 weeks after the Democrat was sworn in. Her first bill, H.R. 8888, calls for an Office of Food Security in the Department of Veterans Affairs. It passed overwhelmingly in the House chamber.
The yeas are 376, the nays are 49, two-thirds being in the affirmative, the rules are suspended, the bill is passed.
Peltola says the topic is important in Alaska, where roughly 10% of the population served in the military. Her spokesman says the bill was drafted in conjunction with the staff of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. The 49 no votes were cast by Republicans, many of them members of the right-wing Freedom Caucus. Anchorage's Centennial Park Campground, where hundreds of homeless residents have camped this summer, is closing on Saturday. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early visited the campground yesterday. Campers and service providers told him they felt in the dark about what would happen next.
On a muddy morning, Raymond Marth is dragging wood through Centennial Park Campground just 3 days before the city plans to shut the campground down for the summer. Marth is a U.S. Marine Corps veteran who lived at the campground for a month and a half this summer until a caseworker got him housed at a hotel. He says he still comes back to Centennial sometimes to help out young campers he's met.
And I came back here because I wanted, you know, the kids over here. You know, I always, you know, sometimes I bring pizza or $40 for Roger to get them stuff. And they're young like my boy, you know, so I got kind of attached to him while I was here.
19-year-old Griffin Hustleton is helping Marth bring the wood to a campsite. Hustleton has stayed at Centennial for almost 3 months since he and his cousin lost their apartment. Hustleton says he was told at the end of the week campers can no longer use the electricity and showers here.
That we're supposed to be kicked out, and if not kicked out, but they're going to turn off the power the 30th. And so that means, and that means it closes the gates too.
While signs pasted on trees around the campground indicate it will close on the 30th, city officials say the closure will occur October 1st. In the days leading up to the closure, many of the more than 200 homeless residents staying at the campground, sleeping in tents and in cars, don't know where they'll go next. Many were bused to the campground in late June when the city closed the mass shelter at the Sullivan Arena. It's likely many will go back there if it reopens. Hustleton, the 19-year-old, says his future is a little clearer than the other campers. He says a caseworker from Covenant House is set to pick him up before the campground closes and move him to housing, but he's not sure what will happen to the others.
Some are weary. They're like, they're going to try and come back after the camp closes. Like, that's going to survive. Like, they're going to survive here still. Like, it's going to work out. I don't know how that's going to work I really don't know how it's going to work.
It's not just campers that are left unsure about where they will go. Local nonprofit Beans Cafe has been providing 3 meals a day at the campsite since the Sullivan Arena shelter closed. Beans CEO Lisa Souter says once the campground closes, her group may have to move its food trailer to just outside the gates.
And I want to check in with the municipality and make sure they don't have any issues with that. But we'll probably move it up near where the office is. Just day by day.
Souter said by Wednesday, she had not heard any word from city officials about what their plans for the campers after the 30th are. While she's committed to continuing food service, she's concerned what a loss of electricity could mean for the campers.
People won't be able to charge their cell phone, which means they can't connect with their case manager or a navigator that's maybe working to get them housing. They can't check in with their probation officer if they have one. They can't charge their ankle monitor. There's some real unintended consequences. I certainly understand the need to shut the water off before the pipes freeze, but I would hope that the power could remain on until people can be sheltered.
The Anchorage Assembly passed an emergency shelter plan on Monday that involves using the Sullivan once again as shelter for up to 150 people. Additionally, the Assembly opted to use the former Golden Lion Hotel as housing, as well as expand operations at existing providers like Covenant House and Brother Francis Shelters. Beans is also set to expand its operations, but since Mayor Bronson hasn't indicated whether he'll use the Assembly's plan yet, Souter says they're left waiting.
We're starting to stand up a 40-person shelter. I need to hire 16 people, but I can't extend an employment offer until I have a contract.
On Saturday, Bronson spokesman Hans Rodvik says city parks and recreation officials will begin cleaning and winterizing the campground while working with health department staff to, quote, transport those who need shelter elsewhere. Rodvik didn't specify where they'd be transported to. While campers wait, Marth, the former camper who returned to help out his former neighbors, says he's not holding out any hope.
I'm not hopeful for everybody here. What are they going to do? There's no help. I don't see nothing happening over here. What are they doing?
Rodvik says the mayor's staff is, quote, continuing to conduct due diligence and evaluation of the Assembly's emergency cold weather shelter plan. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Late this afternoon, Bronson officials said they plan on moving campers back to the Sullivan Arena on Saturday. However, the city's legal department is still reviewing the proposed use of the Golden Lion. Bethel Search and Rescue has expanded their search for the final missing members of a group of moose hunters to include essentially the entire lower Kuskokwim River from Bethel to the mouth. The hunters were last seen alive when they left Bethel August 30th to set up a hunting camp upriver. The bodies of two of the three moose hunters have been recovered. Carl Flynn remains missing. Bethel Search and Rescue expanded the search area after recovering the body of Justin Crow almost 20 miles downriver from Bethel on September 23rd in Napakiak Slough, just a day after the body of Shane McIntyre was recovered near the Bethel Smallboat Harbor. Boaters are being asked to keep an eye on the riverbanks if they travel downriver. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an 8-year study finds that wolves eat much more than deer and moose.
Wolves consume beaver and black bear, and they are consuming sea otters.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
6 more communities are being added to telecommunication company GCI's Aleutian Fiber Project. The massive undertaking is now slated to bring high-speed internet to a dozen communities on the Alaska Peninsula, including 3 villages in the Kodiak Archipelago. KMXT's Kirsten Dobrath reports.
GCI announced last week that the native village of Port Lyons on Kodiak Island was awarded a nearly $30 million grant to hook into 800 miles of subsea fiber the company is currently laying on the ocean floor. The funding also secures future broadband access for the communities of Yuzinki, just to the north of Kodiak Island, Chignik Lagoon, Chignik Lake, Cold Bay, and False Pass. Denise May is the tribal administrator for the village of Port Lyons.
It made so much sense
for us to get this because there's already a project in the works.
GCI started laying fiber up the chain from Unalaska in early August as part of its Aleutian Fiber Project. The village of Larsen Bay on Kodiak Island was included in the company's initial plans to expand high-speed internet service as part of the undertaking. May says that plan made it easier for nearby villages like Port Lions to get their own fiber hookups. She says many communities applied together as clusters so they'd have a better chance tapping into funding.
Individually, we're not enough because we're such small communities. But when we collaborate and there's more of us, it makes more sense to the government to put something in because then they know they're impacting so many more people.
It's hard to quantify just how big that impact will be, according to May. She's hoping that high-speed internet will reinvigorate the economy. Local businesses will have access to a larger market, and younger people will be able to work remotely. Connectivity will also improve residents' access to health care. It's opened a bigger and exciting conversation about the future, according to May.
Next is really rebuilding the community, right? What does our housing look like? What kind of jobs can we put into the community to encourage people to move home? It's a much larger project beyond the internet.
According to GCI, Unalaska homes and businesses will have high-speed internet by the end of this year. Residents in the villages on Kodiak Island will have to wait until 2024 for their new internet services to start. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
Alaska's 60 and older population is the fastest growing demographic in the state. Seniors today make up nearly 20% of the state's population, according to the Department of Labor. And for the first time since 2018, the state is conducting a survey to take stock of the highest priority issues facing Alaska seniors. John Hagiagi is executive director of the Alaska Commission on Aging. He says the survey is a requirement for the state to receive federal funds for services like nutrition programs and caregiver support through the Older Americans Act. And he says throughout the state, his group sees a lot of common trends.
For example, people have transportation issues, isolation issues, cost of living issues.
In 2018, seniors said their highest priority issues were financial security and access to health care. Hagiagi says he's anticipating a new factor to play into this year's survey responses, and that's the pandemic.
We're interested in seeing whether or not people and how they have been impacted as a result of actions taken at their senior centers, impact on their meal deliveries, that type of thing.
The state survey is due by Saturday, October 1st. The Alaska Commission on Aging has a link on its website. Chinook trawlers in Southeast may have left a sizable portion of their allocation in the water when the summer season wrapped up on September 20th, but that doesn't mean it was a bad year. Instead, it was a rather unusual year. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
If you've lived in Alaska for a while, you've probably heard about the short summer king seasons in Southeast, all-out efforts that last anywhere from 3 days to a week beginning on July 1st. That was not the case this year.
Being able to retain Chinook for the entire summer is not something that they're used to.
Right. Commercial trolling for king salmon was open all summer, with only 3 days off to allow silver salmon, or coho, time to escape into their natal streams, lakes, and rivers. Grant Hagerman is the Southeast Troll Management biologist in Sitka. He says the long summer season wasn't due to a lack of king salmon. Rather, it was an abundance of choice. Commercial trolling has changed.
Obviously, they've diversified and have a number of different species they can target. That has spread kind of effort out between those fishing Chinook, those fishing coho, and kind of those fishing enhanced chum salmon.
Enhanced chum, another name for chum salmon reared in a hatchery and released into the wild, completely changed the dynamic of the troll fishery this summer. Trollers caught about 1 million of them, many from a hatchery release site in Deep Inlet, which is just a few minutes' run from Sitka's harbor. Chum have historically sold for around 50 cents a pound, but this year topped out at about $1.20. That's $8 million in chum. Kings are worth about five times as much, but there are a lot fewer to be caught, just 150,000 this summer, and the best kingfishing is offshore, which takes time, fuel, and decent weather to make happen. Hagerman says it's no mystery why so many trollers diverted to chum fishing.
There were about 250 trollers out of a fleet of probably 700 that chose to fish enhanced chum salmon for about 5 weeks. It was basically the end of July and almost all of August while Chinook salmon was open.
As a result, by season's end on September 20th, trollers had left about 9,000 of their summer Chinook allocation in the water, fish that won't be rolled over into the winter troll fishery, which opens on October 11th. Besides the abundance of fish, another significant factor to consider in evaluating the success of summer trolling is the scarcity of permit holders. Hagerman says that there were about 100 fewer boats trolling in Southeast this summer than the five-year average, and perhaps 200 fewer than the 10-year average. Although it would mean a bigger piece of the pie for trollers who stayed in, the summer's high inflation took a far bigger bite out of a boat's income, called ex-vessel value, than anyone anticipated.
I guess you could look at the ex-vessel values as, you know, I would say better than average, but, you know, what you're not looking at is net values. You know, obviously the price of everything is groceries and fuel and everything. And although prices seem to be pretty good, they're not really higher than what they have been the last 5-10 years. And so, like I said, it hasn't really compensated for that huge increase in fuel price.
And while it was not a bad season for coho, at $2 a pound, it was still difficult for trollers to make ends meet with silvers. Hagerman believes that many trollers just decided to wait for the more attractive economics of chum.
There were, you know, a fair number of permits that tied the dock until this enhanced chum sand run started coming through. And then, you know, boats kind of came out of the woodworks. We had boats from all over Southeast that were here for a month, basically.
Hagerman says it's too hard to predict whether this is the new normal for Southeast trolling. There have been large runs of hatchery chum in the past, but the price difference between chum and Chinook kept the fleet's focus on Kings. He hasn't seen many new permits in the fishery recently, and he hopes that the number of trollers working, though lower than past years, levels out. The future is really anyone's guess. As far as the new norm, he says, every year is different. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Tomorrow is a day of remembrance for Indian boarding schools in the U.S. and Canada. It's also known as Orange Shirt Day. The day of recognition was created by a boarding school survivor in British Columbia who had her favorite orange shirt taken away on the first day of school. There were dozens of residential schools across Alaska. Generations of Alaska Native children were also taken from their homelands to attend boarding schools in other parts of the country. There are a number of events happening around the state to bring attention to the damage these schools did to Indigenous children and offer a way to honor victims and begin healing. Ati Nasaya works at AWARE, Juneau's domestic violence and survivor support organization. She says it's a history that many Alaskans are completely unaware of.
Understanding what's happened here and understanding that history allows for us to strive to tend well to the landscape that we live in and to each other in a way that encourages us to support things like language revitalization.
In Anchorage and Juneau, people will wear orange shirts and gather during morning commute times on Friday to wave at drivers and hold signs. Also in Juneau, there will be a formal apology prepared by the Alaska Quakers at Sayik Gastineau School, the site of the former Douglas Island Friends Mission School. A recent underwater discovery on the west side of Prince of Wales Island shows that people have lived in what we now know as Southeast Alaska for at least 10,000 years. And as KTOO's Claire Strempel reports, they also think this discovery helps prove that North America's earliest human inhabitants came down the coast.
What civilization needed to take hold was fish. Lots of them.
Generally, scientists, you know, think that you have to have agriculture to develop a civilization.
That's Sea Alaska Heritage Institute President Rosita Worrell.
I think what we see here is that the indigenous people developed the technology to harvest, you know, significant numbers of fish. So, you know, you can see the beginning of what turns out to be a very complex culture.
Sea Alaska partnered with the archaeologists who recently found a fish weir more than 500 feet underwater in Chacon Bay near Prince of Wales Island. The weir is a rock barrier that was once in an intertidal zone. It redirected fish so that people could catch them. Weirs are some of the earliest forms of fish traps, and they're still used today. Researchers say this particular fish weir is evidence that indigenous people lived in Alaska at least 10,000 years ago. Its depth gives away its age because scientists know how long ago that piece of ocean floor was land. Worrell said the discovery also supports the coastal migration theory.
It was previously thought that the occupation of the Americas was through an interior corridor, but that corridor wasn't opened up until later.
Archaeologist Kelly Monteleone says scientists who think people migrated by land argue that there aren't enough archaeological sites to prove the coastal theory.
But that's because we haven't really looked. You know, the amount of work we've done is so small in comparison to what's been done terrestrially.
Monteleone had been looking for the weir for more than a decade after something that looked like a fish weir showed up on a sonar image. The shadow on the screen was in the right shape.
But until we could actually get eyes on it, we couldn't confirm it was really a weir.
She teamed up with Sea Alaska to locate the weir as part of her graduate research. It wasn't easy. She tried looking 10 years ago, but found out she'd been looking in the wrong place. This year, she found it right away, with a camera mounted on an underwater drone. She knew it was a weir because of the way the rocks were stacked, in a pile that wouldn't have formed like that naturally.
I felt so validated after spending, you know, 12 years of my life talking about this potential fish weir. I've published about it in multiple places. I've presented on this all over the world. And so to finally find it, it was just so exciting.
She'll continue her underwater research with the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute in Southeast Alaska next summer. She'll be tracking down more archaeological sites that explain how and when the earliest people got here. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Claire Strempel.
Southeast Alaska's wolves tend to favor deer and moose at mealtime, but in a pinch, they won't say no to black bear or even sea otter. A study now in its eighth year has found a remarkably diverse diet among the region's wolf population. Although scientists use GPS collaring and other technology in their work, many of their conclusions are drawn from a large and growing collection of scat. Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports.
Petersburg has had a small pack of wolves hanging around the outskirts of town this year. Several residents have zoomed in with their cell phones to capture individual wolves here and there. On social media, a few people said the wolves were stalking them. Others revere the sightings. Biologists have seen the pack on game cameras and think it's a pair with three yearling pups.
Anybody been lucky enough to see the wolves have been hanging out behind the airport?
That's Frank Robbins, the area management biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, speaking at a public presentation in August. This Mitkoff Island pack is part of a gray wolf subspecies known as the Alexander Archipelago wolf. They're specific to Southeast Alaska and tend to be smaller and darker in color than their mainland counterparts. Robbins and other biologists hope this close-to-town pack is an opportunity to learn more about local wolves. They've successfully collared a black male in the pack and hope to get others. They use padded spring traps that capture the wolf by the foot.
We'll have signs up like that anywhere where we would put a trap. We won't put a trap anywhere near where folks are out walking their dogs or where people are likely to encounter a set.
The collaring project near Petersburg is part of a much larger study in Southeast led by wolf biologist Gretchen Roffler. She's been studying wolves in the region for 8 years to find out their eating habits and range.
Southeast Alaska, it's a very large and diverse landscape with
different prey combinations available on these island groups and on the mainland. So, for example, some islands have deer as the primary prey, whereas others have both deer and goats or deer and moose.
To gather data, they've collared wolves from 5 different wolf packs. In the process, they collect information like age, weight, and if the wolf is one of the reproductive pair of the pack. They also take blood and hair samples for studying genetics and diseases. Then they wait. If the wolves hang out in a certain location for more than a few hours, it could be a kill site. And then the scientists move in.
So we're traveling to these sites by all possible means, by hiking on foot, by skiff, by kayak. Sometimes we use helicopters to get close to the sites and then hike in. And once we're there, we scour the ground to look for prey carcasses or parts of the carcasses.
They've studied over 200 sites so far and learned that heavy snowfall is good for wolves. It slows down prey, and the wolves scavenge moose that have starved. Wolves also eat seasonally, sometimes focusing on salmon in streams during the summer. But hooved animals are their favorite.
Wolves really tend to focus on the ungulates that they have available in their area, you know, be it deer or moose or goats.
And they found that Southeast wolves have dozens of alternative prey species. Roffler and her helpers are also collecting wolf scat, lots of it, over 2,000 samples. And with that, they've identified over 60 different prey species. Combining those findings with the kill sites, they've learned that wolves eat beaver, porcupine, marmot, adult black bear, brown bear cubs, even invertebrates off the beach. This alternative prey varies by location.
So in places like Prince of Wales Island, wolves consumed beaver and black bear. On Kew Island, wolves also consumed black bear. And then we have places like Gustavus and Pleasant Islands that are close to protected areas like Glacier Bay National Park, and they are consuming sea otters.
That's right, sea otters.
So far, I have found 31 sea otter carcasses killed by wolves.
Roffler is working on publishing a paper based on these sea otter hunts, which she's personally observed. The Southeast wolves have been surrounded by debate in recent years, with some environmental groups seeking federal protection of the subspecies and some local hunters seeking more harvest of the wolves for eating too many deer. Roffler says she tries to stay away from the controversy and is just interested in the science. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Chris Clint, Liz Ruskin, and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Will McCarthy in Bethel, Kirsten Dobrath in Kodiak, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Jennifer Pemberton and Claire Strempel in Juneau, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.